Kurt Vonnegut's major apocalyptic trio of novels, Cat's Cradle, Slapstick, and Galapagos, prompt broad global, national, and species-level thinking about environmental issues through dramatic and fantastic scenarios. The new book, Lucky Mud and Other FOMA, tells the story of the origins and legacy of what Kurt Vonnegut understood as planetary citizenship, and explores key roots, influences, literary techniques, and artistic expressions of his interest in environmental activism through his writing. Again, the name of the book is Lucky Mud and Other FOMA, a field guide to Kurt Vonnegut's environmentalism and planetary citizenship by Christina Jarvis. Christina is a professor of English at the State University of New York at Fredonia, where she teaches courses in sustainability and 20th century American literature and culture, including the work of Kurt Vonnegut. It is a great pleasure to welcome Christina Jarvis to the roundtable this morning. Christina, thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a joy to talk about Kurt Vonnegut, and especially with someone who embodies so many Vonnegutian virtues like you.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. Thank you very, very much. I have to say that I was really interested in the story when I first got the book, because I guess I didn't think of Vonnegut as someone who was so linked to environmentalism. You make the case brilliantly. What brought you to that particular avenue?
It's a long story, but the kind of light bulb moment for me was when I found this 1972 interview where Kurt Vonnegut was talking about the Breakfast of Champions draft, and he had the Great Lakes disappearing under plastic pollution. And I said, wait, that's not in the novel. And I also happened to be working on Lake Erie beach cleanups and thinking about these issues. And I realized, oh, wait, there's more going on there. So that was sort of like the first thread I started to pull. But it was really when I went back to his manuscripts at the Lilly Library, when I began to find more and more environmental engagement, you know, the fact that he spoke at the first Earth Day, he spoke at nuclear rallies. And I think for me, and I think for a lot of other people, it was like tilting the axis of his career a little bit away from Slaughterhouse-Five to Earth Day and say, what happens when we recenter it? And sort of once I made that mental shift, so many things fell into place.
Because this is a guy that worked for General Electric, for goodness sake.
Yes. Yes. Although, of course, being Vonnegut, he took them to task for the PCBs and the pollution that they put into the Hudson River. He was always standing up for environmental and social justice.
You say he understood his planetary citizenship. How so?
Well, he uses it in Fate's Worse Than Death to mean people who exceed national boundaries, you know, the Beatles, famous writers. But he also, you know, you'll find in his writing, he talks about being a citizen of the earth, you know, being that we are all, you know, people on a shared planet. We're all earthlings together. We have shared human communities, human families. So I think it's a kind of combination of, you know, reminding us of our shared humanity, but also, you know, really his work challenges nationalism, it challenges borders. But there is a real strong environmental and social justice component that I hope the book really helps people to appreciate.
Because he saw writing as activism. So it would make sense that the next step could be or would be very easily environmental activism.
Exactly. In fact, that phrase you were referring to, he said he saw writing as an act of good citizenship, a way of poisoning the minds of young people with humanity in order to create a better world. You know, that's so Vonnegut to say poisoning the minds of humanity. But, you know, he looked at the connections between our, you know, actual environmental poisoning, polluted water, air, as well as our social poisonings, in our cultures, our isolating, dehumanizing technologies, that sort of thing.
I remember in my interview with Vonnegut, he talked about how he was a scruffy writer and that he didn't achieve awards or great prizes because he was scruffy. But isn't that a way of saying that you basically could call people to task and call things out?
That's the thing. I mean, he was always calling things out. I mean, if you actually go back and look at his Earth Day speech, he was calling out greenwashing way back when. You know, he was calling on the fact that these corporations were going to have people focus on picking up litter instead of going for big political change. I think you interviewed him when he was doing Man Without a Country. I mean, he was not shy about, you know, speaking out against war. He would drop everything, you know, to address an important issue. And I think that hurt him somewhat. But I also think it's important for people to realize how hard he worked to make it easy on his readers. There's so much in his draft. And I think part of it, his books really are easy to read at a sentence level, but there's so much more going on in them. And so I think sometimes people, you know, it's because it is so easy to read and digest, you don't grasp everything he's doing with narrative structure, or, you know, so many allusions are easy to slip by. But I hope my book shows there's a lot more complexity and richness, I guess a fourth dimension to the novel. Some of the stories behind the stories, I hope, will make people appreciate all the work. I mean, some of his novels took 2 decades to craft, you know, and I think Vonnegut also kind of played things off. He had a public persona, you know, would tell these neat pat stories, but there's a lot more going on that I try to uncover in the book.
Which you do so beautifully, I think. I was really taken, I think one of his later novels, Galapagos, was really an sort of an overtly environmental novel, wasn't it?
Yes, and yet again, Vonnegut ahead of the curve. I mean, it's really about the Anthropocene. You know, he's looking at us as a species, and for people listening, the novel is set on one level 1 million years into the future and looking at what humanity has become. And spoiler, we've evolved into some feel like flipper folks, you know, which people would perhaps see as devolution instead of evolution. But there's another narrative where he's looking at the events that are happening in 1986 AD. And he's really describing what we now know as the Anthropocene in terms of the impact that we're having on the planet, that we're acting on the planet with the scale of a geological force. And being typical Vonnegut, you know, he's able to, again, call out our terrible behavior, but also in looking at and mimicking the kind of scale of evolution, he looks at all the beautiful things about humanity that we lose, you know, and so I think that novel, I love that novel, and I hope everyone listening goes out and reads it, because it's different from typical climate change fiction or those kinds of things, because it's also laced with humor. You know, it's easier to swallow some of his critiques because there's, you know, amazingly funny and beautiful passages. There's a lot of optimism, too, laced in there. So I'm glad you pulled that novel out for a little shout out. I think it's one of his best, and I hope more people revisit it.
It's an amazing novel, and I think if anything is often overlooked as being a great novel, you make the point, and I had forgotten this, but you make the point about how he incorporates the story of Noah in that novel, which is really fascinating because you're going with Noah, you're going with Eden, and I believe he says in the novel, this to our era of hopeful monsters.
Exactly, and I'm glad you mentioned the kind of biblical allusions, because, again, the richness of that novel, he has sort of a scientific thread, and the science, you know, his grasp of Darwin and evolution is solid. But then he also has this biblical mythic thread. And, you know, I mean, that warning of Noah, you know, it was God smiting sinful humans and a wake-up call. But, you know, he's also mentioning, but it's that backwards reset, going, you know, backwards in time to Eden, you know, with the hopeful monsters that maybe just in the nick of time we'll realize it's our own habitat we're wrecking and that we're not visitors. You know, Vonnegut's always, I think sometimes people focus on the apocalyptic more right. than the warning or the hope.
The hope is interesting because, I mean, it is, you have to look for the hope sometimes because there's a lot of doom in there.
True, yes.
Which is amazing, and it's true, and yet that hope is there. I wonder how hopeful he felt about it.
Well, I think it depends on which Vonnegut. You know, I think Vonnegut generally for the most of his life had this underlying optimism and hope. I think at the very end, you know, the very final years, kind of, he was a brokenhearted American dreamer. He really was very upset about climate change and the wars in Iraq. And I think that Vonnegut was finally reaching some of the pessimism in his book. But if people go back and read some of the speeches he gave in the 1970s and you know, where he's proposing, you know, planetary moral codes, and he's optimistic that we're going to reject our consumerism and extended families, he was just awash in these beautiful, creative, hopeful ideas. And I think that sometimes we, you know, hold on to some of those late life figures or pronouncements and not see him over the course of his career. I think it's actually a plus that I never met him, because I'm able to see him, you know, when I was working with his manuscripts and his novels and papers and everything. Vonnegut was as real to me as a boy taking prairie treks and writing as a teenager as he was, you know, very late in his life. So I could kind of see all those moments at once. And I really hope, again, with the book, that people will look at his career differently, but get out of some of our, you know, the tracks or narrow categories we tend to put him in sometimes.
But there's a maturation of him as a writer from the early books to the later books that really tracks that really well, right? I mean, that brings you to the latter day Vonnegut, but it all makes sense because there's that context of his work as a whole.
Exactly. And I guess I also have to say, too, you know, for someone who was experiencing climate change grief all the way back in 1971, he stopped speaking because he was already thinking about the fate of the planet. And, you know, sometimes to have to sit with our inaction, you know, towards the end, you know, he actually stopped speaking in 1989, I think, because he couldn't face young people with climate change. You know, I mean, it is easy to get, you know, a little depressed when, you know, we still engage in wars, we're still doing these things, and he had been warning about it. So I see, you know, a maturation, but I also see that weariness that comes with trying to, you know, he was like trying to shake the world and our country as a whole, like, hey, stop blowing things up, stop, you know, treating each other like trash, you know. And I could understand how when you get to 84, you get a little weary in that way.
Yeah, you get a little grumpy about things, about the way that you've seen things the way they were and how they are now. I understand that. I can see where that would be a very real thing. I want to go
but
back.
Go
ahead.
I was going to say, but even in that very final speech, which his son Mark Vonnegut delivers, he still ends it with a joke and talks about getting a dog. So even though he talks about the coming apocalypse, that's so Vonnegut, you know, to kind of give us that little bit of humor, that little ray of hope, you know. And I guess I hope that more people can see some of that hopeful ray that really runs throughout his work, but doesn't get enough attention.
We were talking about Galapagos and some of the biblical connections there, but that was something that went, you know, to Slaughterhouse-Five as well. That was something that was a regular feature and of his work, and was fascinating of how he employed it.
And just to give a shout out, there's a book, Forever Pursuing Genesis by Leonard Mestaza, who actually charts, you know, the Eden myth in every single one of his books. And I think that he embraced it for many reasons, but, you know, Vonnegut was also a cultural anthropologist.
Right.
You know, and I think he recognized in, you know, that happened to be a Judeo-Christian creation story, but it's an origin story. It's a human story. You know, he saw these as, you know, as a secular humanist, he saw these as human creations and myths and stories, but he also saw them kind of as foundational stories. So you do see a lot of the Eden imagery in so many of his novels. Absolutely.
Do you have a sense, as you were putting the book together, of how these views were shaped by his early years?
In terms of the biblical connections?
Biblical and environmental, both.
So he said in Wampeter's Boma and Grand Falloons that Ida Young, the black woman who worked in the Vonnegut household as kind of a cook and a caretaker and was a very important figure in his life, exposed him to Bible stories because he came from a long line of German free thinkers. And so he was raised in a very secular tradition. So he really attributed a lot of those stories to her. But in terms of the environmental influences, Hillis Howey, who was a teacher at the Orchard School, which Vonnegut attended, was we would see it as a very progressive, place-based education system now. But he had Hillis Howey, who was kind of an amazing environmental figure who was influenced by like Aldo Leopold and the land ethic. And Vonnegut attributes his thinking and planetary way of being on the planet to Howey. And he also went on this amazing prairie trek in 1937 with Hillis Howey, where he traveled for like 2,500 miles across the American Southwest and really learned a lot of environmental and lessons in democracy and citizenship. And one of the things I do in the book is try to pull out and tease out some of these intellectual influences, but also his own father, you know, his father, Doc, who helped found the Children's Museum in Indianapolis. So he had some key influences, even all the birds that appear in those Vonnegut novels. I mean, Vonnegut was a member of the junior science board on the Indianapolis Children's Museum. You know, he really had a lot of experiences that I think kind of get filtered out that I hope to recover and kind of fill in some gaps with other portraits of Vonnegut.
The idea, and you mentioned it in the title, of planetary citizenship, of where that started to evolve in his life.
His father, Doc, or Kurt Sr., is the one that he mentions as being the first planetary citizen in his life. And he talks about it, again, in Fate's Worse Than Death. His dad would say, well, beauty can be found anywhere on this planet. You know, and he's referring to arts and the musicians and cosmopolitan thinkers. But I think from there, Vonnegut, you know, turns it into, you know, beyond artists to, you know, really thinking of us as having this shared fate as earthlings, as humans, as people on this planet connected by shared biospheres, hydrospheres, atmospheres. But I think you can't divorce the two, because I think for Vonnegut, you know, he really challenged, especially at the height of the Cold War, he challenged like how much violence and war and stuff was being done in the name of nationalism, but also recognized that the same violence was also destroying, you know, human habitats, natural habitats. So the two ideas are different parts of this planetary citizenship are very much connected. And I hope that people, again, see a lot of these interconnections, whether he's talking about technology or war. You know, we tend to think of them as separate, but they do tie back into a lot of these ideas about our shared fate on this planet.
The name of the book is Lucky Mud and Other FOMA, A Field Guide to Kurt Vonnegut's Environmentalism and Planetary Citizenship. I like the way you approach this as a field guide. It's an interesting way to attack it.
And I hope that people, you know, one of the things, I'm not trying to necessarily tell you how to read Vonnegut. I'm just sort of giving you, again, this field guide to some, what I consider very cool, fascinating aspects of his life. And I hope that readers, you know, take what's useful, you know, but FOMA is a harmless untruth, you know, take the ideas from Vonnegut that, you know, will make you brave and kind and healthy and just and help the planet. And, you know, if stuff isn't as useful, then you can leave it behind. You know, what harm will it do? But I hope that people can kind of, you know, take ideas from Vonnegut and ideally, you know, help us all to be better planetary citizens. You know, I don't think it would hurt if we could love humanity both individually, collectively, in the abstract. You know, we might address some of our planetary emergencies a little better if we're a little kinder.
Well, the book is just terrific, and the best thing that it makes you do is want to read more Vonnegut, which is wonderful as well, and certainly in a new way. The book is Lucky Mud and Other FOMA. It is published by Seven Stories. Christina Jarvis, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. And I just have to say, if this wasn't nice, I don't know what is. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, Christina Jarvis is a professor of English at State University of New York at Fredonia. The name of the book, Lucky Mud and Other FOMA, published by Seven Stories. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.